And we're back. Back again. More 1994. Are you ready for this?
Is this going to be like all West Coast shit?
Well, it is 1994, and it is the sound that dominates. I wouldn't say, I kind of split it up for you so you won't get sick to death of, well, all this West Coast stuff, but it was the time, right?
Well, I think it's a big misconception with people when they talk about 94, is they don't realize this is really the dominance of 94.
Yes.
Because when I think of 94, I don't think of this, strangely. I think of, like, the East Coast stuff.
Right, right. Because that's what we were the most into.
Right. So, I mean, well, this series is going to be, like, what, 20 episodes, 30 episodes? So, yeah, we'll get there.
I mean, we haven't even got through breakthrough debut albums, and that's what we are on right now. It's episode 2 of breakthrough debut albums of 94.
So, this is episode 3 of 94, but part 2
actually, it's episode 3. It's actually episode 4, if you think about it, because we did the intro to 94, which all the facts and fun facts, and then we did the crossover hits. And all then right. We did part 1 of the debut
right.
breakthrough album.
You guys following that out there? You guys following that bullshit? All right. Here we go. Part 2 of debut albums. Correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's go.
So, we're going to talk about arguably one of the biggest albums of 1994. It's Regulate, G-Funk era from Warren G, the debut album.
Yes. Everybody loving Warren G. Shout out to everybody messaging. Not everybody. A big fan base for Warren G.
People love Warren G.
People love...
Hawaii loves Warren G.
Hawaii loves and loved and continues to love Warren G.
I you know, what is it? I think it's just he has cruising music, yeah? And it's a car culture in Hawaii. People love driving around, cruising, listening.
That's it.
It's like perfect beach music.
That's it.
You know, you could play Warren G album at the beach.
Yeah.
Yamada around, Yafada around.
Fine.
They don't care.
All right.
Right.
It's family friendly. It's not rough.
Right.
And yeah, that sums it up.
Yeah, and
his
music is very, his production is very soul based.
Right.
And like you said, very clean, smooth music.
Barbecue music.
So absolutely, it's like total barbecue music. And what do white people love more than that?
Let's go hibachi, you know, at the
hibachi
beach.
Hibachi at the beach.
Said by two guys who don't hibachi
yeah,
at the beach.
Nope, I got salmonella poisoning once and I
right?
never went back.
How's that for a representation of Hawaii right now? Us two fucking hapa guys who do not barbecue. Talking about barbecue music yeah. right now.
Shout out to Sean Iman. We both got
oh god.
We both got salmonella poisoning at a beach party from hibachi chicken.
Really?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yeah. So I'm going to take you back to this was the biggest summer album of 94. It was released June 7th, 1994. Oh. So right at the beginning of summer by Def Jam. And it was their soon-to-become Def Jam West label.
Okay.
But this was, like, a very buzzed-about album. Do you remember leading up to it? Because Regulate was released, early
right.
in the year.
Right.
From the Above the Rim soundtrack. We had
right.
all this time to, like, build up the hype.
Big
and
hype.
For those of you guys that don't know the history of Warren G, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have heard the story, but he is the stepbrother. Not the... A lot of rumors were that he was the cousin or the half-brother or the real brother. He's the stepbrother of Dr. Dre.
Yes.
Right? And then the story was that, you know, Dre was kind of always kind of in and out of his life, but after being arrested in 1987, Warren G, you know, got arrested for gun possession.
Yeah.
Dr. Dre bought Warren G his own drum machine and kind of showed him how to trick with it. And that's when Warren G founded the group 213.
That is correct.
His buddy Calvin,
yeah.
a.k.a. Snoop Doggy Dogg, and Nate Hale, a.k.a. Nate Dogg.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is right. And they came out with actually stuff later on in later years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
213 album. And...
Yeah. And it was actually a not bad album.
It was not bad of an album.
Yeah, the groupie. They had the groupie love song, right? Or something
yes.
like that, right? But the 213 mixtape actually started circulating around Long Beach. And then eventually made its way to Compton. And then, you know, Dr. Dre discovered Snoop Dogg because of them. And
right.
formed Death Row Records, first single, deep cover.
Right.
With Snoop Dogg. And Warren was always just kind of there in the peripheral, but left out of Death Row.
Which is interesting that he was left out. You would have thought they'd pick him up and sign him.
Yes.
Right off the bat, along with all of them. But they didn't.
I don't know if Suge thought that maybe Warren G was direct competition to Dre. Do you think that was the case, or he just thought he was a copycat, or I don't know.
I mean, really have no idea.
Because it was really Suge. I heard that was against. Because I think Dre would have took him.
Exactly, because just dominate everybody. Why not have Borangi and Dre? What's the difference? Dominate.
But you know,
it's your business.
We talked about how much Borangi was a pivotal piece to making the Chronic a success, right?
Right.
He's the guy that scouted out the samples. You know, he brought in all the Dog Pound and all those guys.
Right.
You know,
So I don't know what's wrong. I don't know why. That's a good question. I don't know why.
I don't get it. And then it was Warren G had to go and get his own production deal, and he produced Indosmoke for Mr. Grimm. You remember that one? It was for the Poetic Justice soundtrack.
Right. That was played a lot.
Yeah.
It was played a lot here.
It was played a lot here, and the song...
Because it's about smoking, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What do local people like to do? Barbecue.
Right. Smoke.
Eat. Get salmonella. Yeah. Shit.
And people forgot that Indosmoke was kind of a hit in 93. And more people remembered, honestly, more people, I think, remembered Warren G than actually Mr. Grimm.
Quite frankly.
People thought that it was a Warren G song.
Right. People don't remember Mr. Grimm.
Yeah. No. And actually, John Singleton brought basically Warren G to his friend Paul Stewart, who was like a, you know, A&R guy. And then they got the demo of Indosmoke to Chris Lighty at Violator.
Okay.
And, you know, Violator was like the management company, right? So,
right.
You know, they were managing, but LL Cool J,
right.
Busta, Q-Tip.
Right.
I mean, they had like the whole thing. If you guys remember the Violator soundtrack
that came out.
That was all the artists that were signed.
It was like 97, right?
The Violator, yeah, yeah.
There you go.
So they brought Warren G to Def Jam. And Warren said that he wasn't convinced that he wanted to sign with Def Jam because Def Jam was kind of on his way out, seemed like kind of on its way down.
Right.
And then he said he had a conversation with LL Cool J, and it was LL that convinced him to sign to the label.
Wow, how about that?
How's that?
What a sell from LL.
So he signed the label when he was 23 years old.
But, you know, getting back to the conversation of why didn't Suge sign Warren G.
That's interesting.
If you think about it logically, it doesn't make any sense. If you're a businessman,
right?
If you were to go fast forward to 2020, and there was a Warren G S producer and then a Dr. Dre S producer,
right.
And it was, if you were Puff Daddy, for example, you'd sign both of them. Maybe the money wasn't there. Maybe there was a financial problem.
It could be. I mean, but just think about all of the. All of the talent that he also brought, because he also Warren G came with his own crew of guys. So this is a song off the album. This is the Shack with the Dove Shack, who would go on to have a huge hit.
Classic
Summer in the LBC. Summertime
local people
in the LBC.
Love that song.
That was another one too. Local people
the
love
Kanakas
it.
Love it.
He had Waniac and Maniac, or I think the Twins.
That was right. The twins. Yes, Round and Round.
Round and Round.
Local people love it.
And then he had the 5 Footer Crew. Do you remember the
5 Footer
crew?
Yes.
It was all the chicks.
Yes. Local people didn't really catch on to the 5 Footer Crew, but the Twins and Dove Shack, they did.
Yeah. So he had his own like talented roster of artists.
There was a huge following.
He was like a complete package guy, producer, rapper. I mean, arguably not the greatest lyricist. Sorry to our good friend of the show, Russ.
And apparently a lot others. After this Warren G thing came out, everybody seems to be on the bandwagon again.
But he's such a likable guy, a likable personality.
Well, yeah.
And we forgive him for his lack of mic skills. Because he has a great flow, he has a good voice, right?
Yeah, he's fine.
We forgive him on the song What's Next that he...
N-X-E-T.
That he misspells.
It happens... You know, people misspell all the time. People mistext all the time. It's fine. He's fine. We don't need to call him, you know, be like top lyricist. The lyrics are perfect for what he's doing.
That's right.
That's it. It's a complete package. I think it was a financial problem, I'm going to say. I think he probably had a deal on the table and he wanted more, and Suge said, fuck it. Because of that,
yeah.
I'm bringing in the Twins, I'm bringing in the 5 Footers, I'm bringing in Dove Shack, I'm bringing in my talent.
Right.
This is what I want. And he's like, fuck you, you're only 23, I'm not going to buy into this.
Yeah. And maybe Warren probably wanted more of the publishing because everything
it's
produced
publishing.
At Death Row, the publishing was owned by Suge. And that's why, if you guys remember, everybody exited Death Row, Death Row continued to put up compilations of all the old songs
because
he owned the publishing. He could do whatever. They couldn't take any of their shit with them.
I think you solved it right there. It's a publishing. It had to have been. Warren G didn't
I mean, we're purely speculating here, but yeah, it makes sense.
Think of it logically. Warren G wants his publishing. And that's it.
Now, the album would actually go on to sell over 3 million copies. It was 3 times platinum. I think it's close to 4 million at this point, and received 3.5 mics from The Source. What's your thoughts on the album? And do you think that this album is just as important to West Coast hip-hop as The Chronic?
Yes, definitely, as far as historical value. As far as depreciation value, this sound really does not grow tiring. You can still get away with this, especially in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Hawaii, any demographic is going to dig this.
Yes.
I've heard people in their 20s digging this.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not, it's generational. 3.5, yes. We can base that off of a strong 3.5 of the production.
So migrating now and then.
I go same. But historical value, I go 4.
Yeah, I agree.
For historical value.
Mm-hmm.
For musical, all of that nerd shit, 3.5.
And I don't think there is a really crappy song on this album.
No, there's not a crappy song.
No.
There's no crappy song.
Uh-uh.
It's decent.
It's tight. It's a short album. You know, it's to the point. It doesn't have skits on it.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I think we're in agreement. We're in agreement on this one, you know. Even though, you know, the album did get... you know, overplayed for sure.
Definitely.
I think it's one of those albums that it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me
not
much.
At all.
You know what I mean?
Not at all.
I'd rather listen to this than, you know, some of the other gimmicky shit that we're going to be listening to later. Probably, I don't know if in this episode, but in later episodes.
I'm not mentioning any names right now. I don't want to shoot myself in the ass.
Well, let's move on from West Coast and let's talk about an album that was released June 21st of 1994 on Relativity Records from, to me, you know, one of the unsung heroes of Latin hip hop. It's the Beatnuts. It's technically their debut album.
Yeah.
A lot of people speculated that this album was called Street Level because on the cover it said Beatnuts and there was a street level because they took a picture of
right.
the stairs going down to the subway.
Which is an old album cover from right. another
But they, they've gone on record saying, no, the album's self-titled, right. but they just have now accepted it as Street Level.
Right.
And if you look it up on Apple Music and...
It's called Street Level.
It's
right.
called Street Level now.
Go figure. They all just fucked over the Beatnuts with that, didn't they?
But this was the official debut album from Queens-based duo Psycho Les and Juju. I guess like we can mention the members that left, right? VIC and Fashion, aka Al Tariq.
Right.
Do you remember VIC? Do you remember him? He actually was a part of Groove Merchants and Ghetto Pros. I don't know if you remember that production company.
He was in the Intoxicated.
He was
Demons
on the
EP.
Right, and he rapped on World's Famous.
Right.
On this track, World's Famous. And yeah, Beatnuts was originally, it was technically the three guys, it was Psycho Les, Juju, and Fashion.
Right.
And then VIC was kind of like a, you know, like an added member. He was like the Jarobi of the group, kind of like.
He didn't really, yeah.
He's there, he's in the peripheral. Like.
And then Fashion became Al Tariq.
Al Tariq, yeah,
right.
He left
right.
to make his solo project, right? But they were the only Latin group affiliated with the Native Tongue. Right, they weren't Native Tongue.
Not many people know that. Yes,
and so because they got their names from Africa Baby Bam of the Jungle Brothers.
Correct.
So right. you know, Psycho Les is Colombian, Juju is Dominican, and they met each other in high school. They called themselves originally the Beat Kings, and then
not bad of a name. Not bad of a name.
The Beat Kings. No one ever
generic,
did that
though.
Name. Yeah, kind of generic.
It's generic.
But Africa Baby Bam would see them around Queens and different parts of New York shopping at record stores digging for records.
Right.
And basically
That's
said
they
their
became.
Kind of wild, over-the-top sense of humor and the fact that the amount of records they would carry to DJ parties, he was like, y'all are nuts. He goes, y'all aren't the Beat Kings, you're the Beat Nuts.
That's the story.
And the name stuck.
Right.
So, you know...
trying to find a cover of that because the symbol that's on the album is a symbol they use all the time. They use this swirling arrow, right?
Right.
The swirling arrow. It's from something else. So if anybody out there, all you fellow
that
weirdos,
I couldn't even find.
It's from
that
something.
Song.
That swirling arrow is from.
I thought it was
something.
From a jazz thing, but
possibly a jazz thing, an album, jazz album. But yeah, they're known for having all the records. That's why they're such producer extraordinaire people. They were the Beat Nuts because of having all the records.
So many samples. Samples upon samples, right?
Right.
Like unbelievable. And I think what made them unique was, you know, the fact that they needed to stand out from other sample-heavy producers, especially like Diamond D and Pete Rock at the time, who were really like you know, stood out as the premier guys.
Yeah.
And Beatnuts remixes became a thing in the 90s. I mean,
that was trendy for a bit, yes.
But they I think they went with different sounds. They went with, like, vintage children's albums. They sampled, like, Latin music, like samba music and salsa music. And they sampled a lot of big band.
Right.
So...
And it's clean. If you notice, they're getting cleaner.
Right. Their first production, I don't know if you remember, they produced the entire Chi Ali album.
Yeah. And that was still rough.
They were not, they were guys that were producers first and then wanted to be rappers.
Yeah.
You know, but then they were just being more like taken seriously as producers, kind of like the Kanye situation.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
Right.
These guys were only like 25 and 23. Juju was 25, Les was 23 at the time. These guys are talented, and you know who really saw their talent first more than anyone else was the Brits, because their first remixes were for Stereo MCs and Moni Love.
Correct. Yes.
So it's like,
yes, Brits are always on top of the game.
The Brits are on top. But Stereo MCs is a talk for another time.
Did we talk about Stereo MCs before?
I think we mentioned them, but we never really got to go into.
Never had a half an hour Stereo MCs conversation.
We have not.
Oh God! Oh damn.
But we definitely will talk about Stereo MCs in
future
episodes.
Good, wonderful.
But then they went on to produce for Common, right? Pete Nice and Daddy Rich,
right?
The Youngstas, Fat Joe, Curious George.
You could tell they evolved with every group they, because Pete Nice and Daddy Rich Beatnuts is
they
not
did
the
Rat
same
Bastard,
as,
right?
Which is not as good as like a Fat Joe Beatnuts song. The production changes with the people that they. It seems like they screw people over on some, and they get because Rat Bastard did not sound good, but Beatnuts with Fat Joe sounded good. It's strange.
I think it's like any producer, right?
I guess
how close they are with friends, and how much they're, you know, maybe guys are paying, or how much maybe
how much
the Beatnuts are, if their producer is a fan of the MC,
it's exactly
then they give the guy a little bit more
attention,
right?
Because they could just be making beats and you just buy a beat. That's what these guys would do, right? They would just, I have a bunch of beats. Which one you want? Okay, that one you want? Okay, 30 grand. And then maybe that's what happened. And I don't know. You could tell it seemed like a favoritism or something. I don't know. Are people just buying the wrong beat? You think Pete Nice would know what beat to buy? But the Rat Bastards sucked. Rat Bastards was garbage. But it was a Beatnuts.
You're
beat.
More of a Kick the Bobo guy. That's
Kick the Bobo's better than
but
Rat
Bastards. But that's not.
And it's not even Beatnuts.
That's not Beatnuts.
But
yeah.
Then the Fat Joe, like, Watch the Sound, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was Beatnuts remix, right? Watch
they
the Sound.
They did a remix for it, yeah.
Right. Way better than Rat Bastard.
Right.
So it's weird. That's the same era, though.
I think probably Beatnuts probably had a crap ton of beats.
That's probably it.
And made over a different period of time. And as they'd gotten from 92, when they were doing Chi Ali's album, to 94, they obviously evolved. They got better and better as producers.
Right.
So I think it's just when the artists would catch up. Obviously, Pete Nice was probably the earliest one.
Right.
Right.
That's why it's an evolution. And then this album, if you notice the production, clean. Their best beats, obviously, because it's them.
Right.
And it kind of took us by surprise, because if you look at the Intoxicated Demons EP, where they had the one song, the Pop the Trunk, and they're yelling, and they kind of just fit the mode of the yelling vibe back then. But
Reign of the Tech.
Reign of the Tech, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's no Reign of the Tech kind of vibe on this. It's all smooth out, mellow, boom bap still.
Yeah.
Clean, though.
Yeah.
Totally different from Intoxicated Demons. So
the sound did clean up. Yeah, that 93 Intoxicated Demons EP. Did you have the vinyl? Yeah, actually were able to grab the vinyl.
And then that had No Equal on it.
No Equal. It was a solid one.
Yeah,
World's Famous.
World's Famous.
Yeah, Psycho Dwarf.
Psycho Dwarf was fine.
Yeah, Reign of the Tech.
The lyrics were very rough, very brutal at times.
Yeah, I mean,
but,
again, these are producers over lyricists.
It seems
like, and they have that in common. Warren G. Not the greatest rappers. They had a couple clever punchlines, but we're not gonna ever put the Beatnuts in an elite MC.
I mean, the one that always gets me is I think it's Psycho Dwarf, where it's a great beat, and then when they come in, they want to fuck, drink beer, and smoke some shit.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm like, you guys just killed the fucking song.
Yeah.
What is that intro?
Yeah.
And that was the chorus, right?
Yeah, and that was the chorus.
It was awful.
It ruined the song.
It
for
ruined
me.
The
yeah.
song. It was a great beat.
Yeah.
So, can't play it anywhere.
And then another thing they had in common with Warren G, they were also signed to Violator.
Yes.
So, you know, so Violator was really finding some talent. So the album released three singles. It was Props Over Here, Hit Me With That, And then I don't know if you got these rare remixes that was hunting for at the time. They were only on vinyl. Hellraiser remix.
Hellraiser remix, yep.
Get Funky remix.
Get Funky remix.
And then there was a non-album single called Fluid. I don't know if you remember that one.
Fluid was a B-side of something.
Yeah, so, but then that was like always like one of those.
A white label.
If you were like a... You know, if you were like hunting for stuff
that shit.
Back in the day,
you're
right?
A hardcore beat nut maniac, a beat like, nut job.
But yeah, Fluid was it was hard to find. It was something that I would go all to Sam Goody and Tower and always try to be hunting to get the Fluid B side.
You're the only one in Oahu doing that shit.
So but, the source would give the album 3.5 mics. They said it was overall
really?
Satisfying album.
That's it?
No, they just said it was. Oh. They said it was. They said production wise, great. Lyric wise, you know,
okay,
okay, that was the review. What's your mic rating now and or then and now for Beat Nuts?
Well, we gotta talk about one song in here that will solidify the mic rating is gonna be the one with Grand Poobah. Are you ready?
Oh, are you ready?
That's an excellent song.
Let's play that.
Grand Poobah kills it, of course. 94 Grand Poobah is gonna be dominant, and great beat matches him. This is one of the best songs of the album.
Great beat. I agree.
You could get away with this song now. So let's go with the rating as far as depreciation. Depreciation is strong. I give this a 4-mic album.
Solid
4-mic album. Because of the production alone. Once again. The lyrics, it's decent enough to get away with it that doesn't ruin the song.
Right.
Like, the lyrics here, this is like Psycho Less, right?
Right.
It's fine. It doesn't kill it. It's not him saying, I want to fuck, drink beer, and smoke some shit again and again and again. So it's okay.
The thing is, they're not saying anything deep.
Right.
Right.
But they're not saying anything stupid. You know, where they're not saying, I want to fuck, drink beer, and smoke some shit. How many times am I going to say that? But 4 mics then, 4 mics now. You can still play this in the car. I would still play this in the car. You could still get away with this in a lot of demographics. I think that people that if a kid's into hip hop, I think they would dig it. That's in their 20s or 30s.
Right.
Depreciation. I would even go 4.5 for Depreciation because this is a legendary group of producers.
Right. And I think that for beat makers, this is a great album to go back to. Just listen to the beats. I think the beats are so good that you forgive anything on the mic.
Exactly.
You know
right.
I mean? Like,
just pay attention to the beats.
It was like a Diamond D album. We're not listening to Diamond D for lyrics.
No, it's just the overall fun.
It's the overall,
So Depreciation, historical value is 4.5 because of their history as producers. Because this ain't by no ways the end of them. They get bigger and bigger throughout the 90s.
You actually used this beat for the one of their loops for the podcast that you were doing for the Sleep Times Over Habit.
Yeah.
Weren't you?
This was the intro for a bit before we got the theme,
So,
I dig it.
It's a classic. Man.
It's a classic beat.
Alright.
Okay, here we go. This is a good one. But yeah.
That's a good one. Alright. Now we're going from an album that we love, obviously the Beat Nuts. We're going to an album that's
what
debatable.
Oh,
it's the Brat. Now.
Alright, well. Okay.
Now, we talked about her already, so we don't need to go too far.
Thank you.
on it, but you know, the debut album of Chicago native Shante Harris, The Brat. This was released on June 28th of 1994 on So-So Def Columbia Records. We talked about her, you know, getting the start in the business, beating Criss Cross, getting the audition, you know. Now, is there anything, like, what'd you think of this album when it came out?
Okay. I never bought this album. I never heard this album.
Wow.
I was never interested in this album.
Just heard the singles because it was hard to escape them.
And I liked I think it was Give It To You.
Right.
Because of the horn. That was it. I get what she was trying to do. We talked about it before.
The Give It To You, the original or the remix?
The one that they... Not this one.
Yeah.
It was the
probably
remix.
The remix, right?
The one with the horn.
Right.
Do you have that going?
Let's see here.
With Bill Bellamy in the video. Shout out Bill Bellamy. Is that it?
I don't know.
That's Mary Jane Girls. No, that ain't it.
I don't know.
You don't have the remix? Then all shit is lost. Because I've never was interested in buying this album. I just didn't get into it. I mean, I get the idea of the Brat. I get the gimmick. I don't want to go into this again, but shit. Listen to the previous episode about the Brat, all right? She has a long career. That's right. Totally fine. She pivoted many different directions. I just didn't know what the appeal. This ain't it.
Man.
Why is this hard to find?
I don't know. I'm curious to find out which one.
This is it. No, wait. This might be it. Hurry up. All right, we ain't got all day, Brad. Let's go.
Well, she recorded this album when she was 18. It's only 9 tracks. They did it in only like a few weeks. JD like wrote almost all the lyrics, all the beats, right?
Is this the instrumental? What do you have? We got the instrumental.
It's like the extended remix.
Oh, one of those.
Yeah, one of those. You know,
32 bar.
Yeah. Like if you really, really like the song, you want 8 minutes of it. Like
really, this is it, I think. That part, that sample I like.
That dan dan.
Yeah, it was very 94 vibe-ish, this song.
So
I like this song. This is a 4-mic song, right?
In the beginning, like, I don't want to say she was kind of like JD's puppet, but in a way, like, he created her image, he dressed her, he wrote all the lyrics. I mean, he did that with Criss Cross, too, so it seemed like JD was not just surprised. That guy. Right? Yeah. He wanted, like, complete creative control over these acts. You know, the Brat would eventually go and write her own lyrics and do that stuff, but this is basically a JD album, if you think about it, or JD and the Brat, right?
And he made her bigger than life. Like, this video has all kind of celebrities in it.
That's right.
Everybody's all in it. Biggie's in this video.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
She did a song with Biggie, the B-side. I mean, he made her larger than life, and he really marketed her very well.
And then JD did a Social Dev remix for Big Papa.
Right.
That's right.
Right. So marketing-wise, I get it. It was very smart on his part to do so. Made her bigger than life. I just didn't buy into it. I just didn't buy into where I had to buy the album.
I know this conversation will come up later in future episodes too, but favorite female MC of all time for you? Do you have one or at least one that would be in the conversation for you? I mean, I know me and you are both MC Light fans. I mean...
Yeah, see, whenever the topic...
she just never had a classic album in mind.
No, she never really did. She never really had a hit, and I'm not talking about Roughneck. No. You know, when I think of female rappers, though, I guess I'm just a male chauvinist, because I just think of, like, who would I date? So if I would date one of them, I'd probably date Moni Love.
Wow.
Or MC Light.
Swerve.
I would date MC Light and Moni Love. I would ask MC Light out and see what she would say. How the conversation would go. But then I think it would be Moni Love in the back of my mind being, maybe I can talk to Moni Love.
Yeah, you're not gonna date at later age.
maybe you gotta talk story. Not dating. And you know what too? I'll say this in regards to Queen Latifah. Okay. Queen Latifah's cute. Okay.
Yeah.
She's an attractive woman. Still attractive.
Best
now.
Looking Latifah is living single Latifah, right?
Right. Because you got Pro Africa Queen Latifah, living single Latifah.
Right.
And then you got Latifah still, she still looks like how she looks now. It's like she doesn't age.
Yeah.
It's very strange. But she's gay though, right?
Right. Now she came out.
So,
right?
You know, shit.
But she's actually like? Probably always been gay, but then she just never came out. And we
probably.
Just noticed that she was never out with anybody, right? She was always with the guy that was co-owner of Flavor Unit.
Right. But she plays a straight woman in a lot of her roles. She's living single, she plays a straight woman.
Right.
But is MC Light gay?
No, that
she's
was
straight.
Debunked. Yeah, she all was right. On an interview and said she's not. But
okay.
The Brat's come out. I told we
the
said
Brat
that on
gay.
The other episode. She came out.
Is Moni Love still alive?
Moni Love's still alive, far as I know. You know, but like
she's straight, I think.
What about rappers like Bahama Dia or like Nefertiti or anything like that?
From what I vaguely remember of what Nefertiti looks like,
was she
cute?
Dope MC.
She was great, but was she cute?
And we already got know your opinion of Lauryn Hill.
She can get out of here. Would
boy,
I date Lauryn Hill?
From that statement right now.
Would I date Lauryn Hill? I don't know. I think I'd be annoyed. Like, we'd be going out to eat. I don't know if the conversation's going to go on a good turn. It's going to be like maybe some annoying shit. And then, like, I'm going to want to go to the bathroom and, like, not come back or something. I don't know about Lauryn. But I think Nefertiti was cute. And I'm sure we're missing a lot of other... in this male chauvinist segment of the show, which I know if you're a female listening to this, you're telling us to fuck off right now. I get it. But yeah.
But you know, I would love it if anybody, you know, like messages the show and lets us know who their top three or top five female MCs are. We'd be curious. I'd be curious to see.
Okay, I'll sell four of those to you.
but you know, the one thing we can't deny about the Funkified album from the Brat is that, you know, it was a huge album, right? It was groundbreaking for a lot of reasons, in the sense of, you know, it was the first female solo album to like debut at number one
as a female,
you know, debut number one album on the rap charts, go platinum, you know, single, platinum album. You know, it was so big that they, like, remember they released like the clean version, the dirty version,
right,
all these EPs, and they like a remix album, Mo Funkified.
Very,
and it's like
impressive marketing by Jermaine Dupri.
And for a 9-song album, it had quite a bit of longevity.
You know, I haven't listened to this album, but I'm going to give it its just due here. I think its historical value is very strong.
Okay.
I'm not going to give much on the mic rating because I didn't listen to it.
Right.
But historically, this era of the Brat is a big history lesson for people, because women did not sell and have this kind of marketing backing that she did.
Right.
Men bought this album, uh-huh, which back then men didn't really buy the Queen Latifah, Yo-Yo, all of that. Yo-Yo was cute too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Yo-Yo I wouldn't. Yeah, I would Yo-Yo. But I digress. Historically, the Brat is has her place in the hip hop history.
I agree.
And she was the start of getting the masses to buy a female rapper album. Like, we looking at today with the Nicki Minaj,
the Missy Elliott.
You look at from there to Lady Rage, to Eve, to Missy Elliott, Little Kim.
Yep. Foxy.
She paved the way in a lot of essence on selling.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
On marketing.
Yep.
That men can be cool listening to a female
and
rapper.
I would argue that she was one of the few female rappers that it was all right if a guy was playing it.
Correct.
He wouldn't be ridiculed.
Correct. Right.
You know.
So that's the historical value.
All right. So I've never found a source review on this. I don't think the source reviewed it.
Oh, really?
I was looking all over for it.
They
might have, but I like scoured the internet looking at all of the old source magazine sites, and I couldn't find a review.
That's
so if
surprising.
Any of you guys know or have that old source mag, I mean, that'd be cool. I'd be curious to find out what the source gave it. I would imagine they probably give it 3.5. If I had to guess.
Probably. I'm surprised that they wouldn't.
But if you didn't listen to it, then I guess I'll have to give my mic rating for then and now.
Here we go.
I would say back then, I probably liked it more than I like it now. So I give it like 3.5 back then. And I would say depreciation. There is some depreciation here. So I give it 3 now.
All right.
All right.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Okay.
Good enough. I'll take
it. Well, moving on now to another West Coast artist.
All right.
Who we also had talked about on the... crossover singles, it's Coolio.
Oh, that's right.
And
that's right.
He is probably the oldest rapper we have on this, because he didn't break through until he was in his 30s. He's been around for forever.
Yeah. So that's the thing people don't realize is when Coolio first came out, they didn't realize this guy was an old guy.
Right.
I mean, he looks like an old guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like a really
old
guy.
He looked old when we first started hearing him in 94. So the album is called It Takes a Thief, right?
Yes.
It was released July 19th of 1994 on Tommy Boy Records.
Yeah.
And it was the debut album of Artist Ivy is his name. Artist Ivy, a.k.a. Coolio.
Go figure. Artist.
Now.
A-R-T-I-S.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Artist Ivy. And he got his start in the late 80s rapping with a group called New School that were actually affiliated with World Class Wrecking Crew. New School was signed to Ruthless Records for a bit. I don't think they ever released anything, but that was Coolio's first record deal.
Coolio was like 50 back then, too. In a group ironically called the New School. Coolio, the Wilford Brimley of hip-hop. Never was younger.
And then
never young.
They would get dropped, and then he would join a group called the Mad Circle in 1991 with the rapper WC.
That's right.
Right. So
this song is hot, though.
This is the best song on the album.
It's the best song on the album.
It's the best song on the album. And it was the first single.
Right. Which gave it a lot of... Well, for me, I was like, wow, this is a WC and the Mad Circle guy. This is hot. And this is like, shit, this is going to be great. And then everything changed.
I think the production on the album shifted when I think when Fantastic Voyage blew up before the album came out. Maybe they went back and reworked the album and were like, we need to get more singles on here. Right. We need some more singles. So maybe that was the case?
It had to have been. I didn't expect Fantastic Voyage to blow up, though, as big as it did.
Right.
It was a great song. I thought, okay, he's doing a fun one. This was right when Fantastic Voyage came out. I bought the CD.
Right.
Yeah, okay, it's a fun song. Okay, different than Conny Line. Okay, I still dig it. But for it to blow up.
That big.
Yeah, I was amazed. I mean, I get it looking back, but... Yeah,
I think it was a combination. It was like
a cruising song.
It's a cruising song. It had a fun video.
Yeah.
He had the comedy in the video.
The video made it too.
Right. The video was big. Yeah, the video was big. MTV put it on super heavy rotation.
Yep.
He was performing live on MTV.
Yep.
Right. But he was 30 when this song came out. So he's by far the oldest rapper.
He was not fucking
30. He was 30. But that's what they claim.
Bullshit. Quite frankly, people out there, you go rewatch Fantastic Voyage. Now I know they put makeup on people when they do videos and whatnot. He brother didn't look 30.
Well, yes, he did look older, but that was
right.
That was supposedly from the birth date that was given on the interweb.
Okay. Shout out Wikipedia changing shit.
But County Line would release in 93.
Yeah.
And it was really a single that only circulated around hip hop fans as DJs.
Yeah.
It didn't get any radio play.
No.
Nobody knew about it. And you know, then Fantastic Voyage came out, it exploded, and then he released some other singles, but nothing ever took off from this album.
Oh, I forgot about this song. This song sucks.
This is I Remember with J-Roll of the Alcoholics.
Yeah. This was okay. I remember the video for this. They played the video of this because this was right after
Fantastic
Voyage.
Were they in a junkyard or something? Or?
Something like that. And then they had some big Soli guy who was not a Soli guy.
He was not Booyah Tribe.
He was not Booyah Tribe, but he was singing this. So then I get it. The local people love, like, this guy. Who is this guy? LV?
Oh, LV, the singer?
This is the singer?
Yeah, he would go on and, like, try to...
He had something,
like,
tried to do something.
South Central Cartel. He was the singer for South Central Cartel.
Right.
And everything.
But, yeah, this song got annoying real quick. I give a rip about back in... I don't like back in the day songs. Back in the day songs were always like a thing.
It doesn't seem like anything back in the day. You want to live in the now.
Well, it's, you know, I don't want to take it a step further. But anybody doing a back in the day song just always sucks. It's just, this was an era of like Ahmad doing this. I Remember.
Right.
Dred Scott. What else? Illegal. Everybody's back in the day. Back in the day.
Yeah.
Hey, move forward, people.
Get
move
a job.
Forward. Get a job. Figure out your life now, right?
Yeah, I mean, the album was only really made from Fantastic Voyage. I mean, it was that single that basically made the album a smash.
Right.
Because there wasn't anything other single that was really memorable, right?
This was a returned album at Jelly's, I bet. This was a top one.
But I was shocked at the longevity of Coolio's career with, like, right?
Yes, he did.
Wow. I mean, he waited way longer than we ever expected, right?
I think because he put his name out to all different kinds of projects. He did acting.
Right.
He did, like, cameo appearances on things. He's got this goofy look.
Sitcoms and
sitcoms.
Yeah.
He did that Space Jam song, right?
Right, right, right.
He kept his name out there.
The Hit 'Em High, the Posse Cut.
Right. And then 1, 2, 3, 4
song.
1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah.
He kept his name out there.
The song that we both hate, Gangster's Paradise.
Culminated with that. Yep. That
Which
was
his biggest hit.
That was a major
beat. That surpassed even Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah, of course. Right.
You know, but what do you think? Did you get to listen to this entire album?
No.
No, you never did? You never owned it?
We're 0-for-2 in these in these latest two albums.
Yeah, the production was done by Dobbs the Wino, who I guess was one of WC's producers.
Yeah.
And the production sounds a lot like kind of Sir Jinx, like Ice Cube era Sir Jinx.
Yeah.
It has that kind of...
it's not QD3.
It's a West Coast, but it's more sampled West
Coast.
Right? It's old drum machine, not G-Funk slick.
It's not G-Funk at all.
Right.
Yeah. This is the last remnants of the old style.
Surprisingly enough, the album, very well received by critics. 4 mics in the source, like, hot, like, good ratings on Rap Pages, Rap Sheet. Did you ever listen to this thing? Can you review this thing, or...
No, I can't. Okay. But what could the reasoning be for them to give this a better review than the Beatnuts?
I think that
lyrics wise he's better.
Lyrically, I think they're going lyrical content.
But I think it's the trend of West Coast. Anything West Coast is going to hit and make it bigger than an East Coast right now, because everybody's mindset is in the West right now. They're just loving West Coast stuff. So here's another West Coast guy, but he sounds better lyrically. He gets the bump up to 4.
Yeah.
I think that might be it. If we fast forward to say, like, if the East Coast was dominating the radios and whatnot, would this still get a 4, being not the East Coast sound?
Mm.
You know, I think maybe they're just jumping on a bandwagon a little
bit. Yeah.
Because I can't, this is not a 4 mic album.
No. I think probably back then I probably enjoyed the album just because it was, like, the hype album, and I'd probably give it 3.5 back then. I'd probably give it 2.5 to 3 now.
Yeah.
Just because there's not a lot of songs that I would go back to.
There's
probably County Line. You know,
I would listen to County Line and that'd be it. I would listen to County Line in the car right now in 2020.
It's his best song he's ever made for me.
Yes.
Is it the same for you?
It is his best song.
Yeah.
After that, I don't know much. I'm not listening to Fantastic Voyage ever again.
Oh, yeah. That's why I purposely did not play it.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, going on to another group that I think you and I are both fans of. And if you remember, we kind of bonded on this group when we first met.
Really?
We talked about them. It's the Grave Diggers.
That was our first conversation?
No, they were mentioned, though. Oh, okay. They were mentioned. All right.
What a convo that must have been, huh, everyone? Shit.
I think you made I think you had actually quoted this song, "A Suicide." It's a suicide. And
did I do that when I said hi to you? Is that the intro?
Maybe that's what you felt after you met me.
Well,
I hope
that's
not
here nor there, but I always dug this album.
Do you feel like this is a slept-on album, or do you feel like it gets the respect that
I think it gets the respect. It lived up to the hype, kind of, because we never heard of a super group before. And when we first heard of the rumors of this group, it was from these different groups.
Let's be frank. That's a very loose term with this group, because we only have really 2 superstars.
There's only yeah. Well, back
then. And that's
then,
a quote unquote. All right. You know, that's a hard quote unquote. Right?
This ain't a big 3, LeBron, but I'm just saying it was back then. You never heard of these different groups forming another group then. We don't have to say super.
Yeah.
Because we had the guy from Wu-Tang, and they're like, right. Oh, wow, the guy from De La Soul. Oh, the guy from Stetson Sonic. Oh.
Yeah.
And then Fruit Quan. Which, Too Poetic, nobody really gave a shit. But we're like, oh, yeah, Too Poetic is a group too. Okay, so 4 different groups came together. So we didn't know what to expect. And then they called themselves this, and we didn't know what they were going to do with it.
Right.
And they went this horror thing, but they're not really horror. It's Gravediggers, like they're murdering the MCs.
They never dubbed themselves horrorcore. They were actually dubbed by a music critic as horrorcore.
Right.
And we already talked about, as far as the history of horrorcore and music, I mean, Esham in Detroit and Insane Poetry in Seattle, they were already doing that kind of weird stuff. You know what
I mean? Don't forget the Flatliners.
And the Flatliners and Gangster Nip. I don't know if you've heard Gangster Nip.
No,
so all of these guys were actually doing that horrorcore.
That was music. Horrorcore.
And shout out to Bushwick Bill. He was already rapping
Bushwick
about
Bill,
Chucky
right?
and
right.
kind of stuff like that.
So they weren't horror guys.
Right.
But they called themselves like the Undertaker.
Right. So,
you know, Resurrector.
The Resurrector, the Undertaker, the Gatekeeper, and the Grim Reaper.
Right.
But the album was released August 9th, 1994. Did you buy this when it came out?
Yes.
It was on G Street Island Records.
Yes.
And the album was called 6 Feet Deep.
Yeah.
The original album, they submitted it to G Street Records. It was Igga Mortis. And you can put the letter in front of that and guess what that album's called, but it was Igga Mortis.
That's right.
And the album, the G Street execs were like, yeah, no.
That's not gonna happen. That's right. Well, I remember the single, once again, Sam Goody. It was...
Nowhere to Run, or...
No, the first single was
Diary of a Madman.
With
that's
Constant
right,
Elevation.
That's right.
That was an incredible single. When I first heard that, I was like, holy shit. Because then Diary of a Madman gave them the horrorcore feel.
Right,
because
yeah, the court, it has this court
dramatic
scene.
Thing, right?
Yeah, this court scene in there.
Right, but they're not talking about murder. They're not talking about horror. It's an MC battling kind of a thing, but made to sound like a horror. And then Constant Elevation, excellent. And it was an... That single was like a 5-mic single. 4.5. I'll go 4.5 on that single. On this and Constant Elevation.
There was nothing that sounded like it at the time.
No.
That was cinematic. And,
no.
And I still don't think, like... Yeah, the RZA and Prince Paul together production, it's pretty pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
It's so let's give the younger listeners like background, because they probably don't know what the hell they're talking about. Why are you listening to
this show? If they're even listening to this, let's quite frankly.
But the group was made up of the RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan, the Resurrecta, right? Who's the Resurrecta?
Yeah.
He was 24 at the time of making this. Yes. And he was doing this while Wu-Tang was going on.
Correct.
Right? Prince Paul, who was 26 at the time, right? Who had just come off of pretty heartbreaking situation with De La.
Right.
Right? Not as far as, like, because the samples were being, like, there was a sample scrutiny for De La Soul's
Some problems
dead.
There, yes.
Right. To me, the Prince Paul masterpiece is Balloon Mind State. It's still his, arguably his greatest one. I know a lot of people still mention that Handsome Boy Modeling School. I personally like the production on Balloon Mind State the best for him.
Oh, yeah, by far.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think it's his masterpiece.
That's a great one. That's a five mic album. But this single, nothing ever came out like this. Set the tone. This was like several months before the album released, right?
This single? This single was the first one.
This came out like in June or something?
Yeah, I want to say it came out like probably May or June.
Yeah.
Right? And then so the other members, ready. We don't want to forget the other members. Fruquan, which you mentioned.
Yep.
And Too Poetic.
Too Poetic.
And Fruquan was of Stetsasonic with Prince Paul, so they both left. Right. And then Too Poetic, I don't know where he came from. He was a solo artist, I'm guessing. Right?
I don't think Too Poetic knows where he came from. But it's a great album. And okay, so here's the thing with the Source review that they gave, which I kind of agree. The first half of this album, excellent. Second half of this album, it's a stretch. Bang Your Head. I remember that was pretty brutal. And
Bang Your Head.
The ending of the album sucked.
Here Comes the Grave Digger.
Mommy,
right?
What's a Grave Digger? I think was a thing.
Graveyard Chamber. Death Trap. Yeah.
So they put all their hits, quote unquote, in the beginning.
The beginning of the album, you think it's gonna be a classic.
You're like, wow, one after the other, and then bang your head. And I'm like, no, that's not gonna work. So it's historically the first half of the album, 4.5 mics. Possibly, maybe 5. Second half of the album, 2 mics.
So it kind of evens out to a 3.5.
I gotta go 3.5.
But you know that you know the formation, right? The formation was that Russell Simmons gave Prince Paul his own record label at Def Jam, but basically they wouldn't clear his samples. Yeah. Couldn't get any albums released.
Right.
The artists that he'd bring in, they would say no, they're not good enough, or
wouldn't
do it. So basically, like. And then they also had beef with Tommy Boy, because they were signed, and then Tommy Boy dropped them.
Right.
So they, you know, like, and this was also mentioned by the GZA as well, right? So they all had beef with Tommy Boy. And then that was the catalyst for the Murdering MC sound and going crazy and everything. But
that was it, yes.
But yeah, man, I think the album is still extremely listenable now. The singles are, the singles were awesome.
The first half.
The first half. And did you get that rare Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide Portishead remix? Do you remember that?
That is a hard to find one, which, well done if you have it to play right now.
Let's see.
Do you have it?
Let's see if...
That's very rare, hard to find.
Yeah. I mean, it was one that I was looking for.
Well, this original Nowhere to Run is a classic as well. Great video for this. You guys haven't seen the video of Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide. Great video.
Here we go.
You have it?
This is it. This is on YouTube only, though.
Oh, okay. This is very rare.
They were also groundbreaking, because probably the RZA and Prince Paul were probably the only, like, open-minded guys to, like, let's work with Portishead. Let's work with this British down-tempo.
Exactly. Because everybody was thinking out of the box back then, and they were trying to be different back then.
Right.
So it was not too much of a surprise that they would jump in. Plus, the European-American connection, hip-hop-wise, was strong.
Right.
So
the album got 3.5 mics from the Source. I think it makes sense, because I think the argument is the same. But, you know, pass on the skits. We don't need the skits.
Too many. The skits got cheesy at the end. The last 4 or 5 songs sucked.
Yeah.
They sucked. They put out Suicide as a single.
Right. It was 1-800-SUICIDE, Diary of a Madman, and Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide for the singles.
Those are fine as singles. And this was pretty much the beginning of the end of this group, because after this,
that was it. The sophomore album just didn't live up to expectations. I think they were probably all in different mind states.
The pick, the shovel, the axe,
the sickle,
the sickle, the pencil. But then Prince Paul wasn't even on that album, right? He was like on one song or something.
I think RZA took over for that one.
Right, and then
Prince Paul was the lead producer on this, with RZA kind of backing him up, and then it was reversed almost,
and you could tell
RZA was bigger. Probably it was an ego thing, you think? That, like, RZA was bigger maybe at the time, so...
When you have minds like that, ego gets in the way. And you could tell it was a RZA album, that second album.
So are you giving it 3.5 back then and 3.5 now, or are you giving it 3.5 back then, 4 now, 4 mics now?
No, I would go 3.5. I would go 3.5 back then. I'll go 3 now.
Because the album just... If you play singles, you won't play the entire album.
Right. I mean, I would not listen to this entire album in the car. I would listen to maybe Nowhere to Run. I'll listen to Constant Elevation. The only song I'll probably listen to from the beginning to end will be Constant Elevation. One, because it's the shortest.
Yeah.
Two, because it was good overall. And, I would not be able to listen to Diary of a Madman in the car. There's no way anybody loving life is going to listen to Diary of a Madman in the car in 2020. And hanging out, feeling good. Sorry.
I still like 1-800 Suicide. I like Constant Elevation, and I'd still like Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide. I like the original and the remix. I like both.
Right, the remix is great too. Yeah, Nowhere to Run. Yeah.
All
right,
we'll go with another huge album, more of a crossover album than anything else, but an album that kind of like fit in between the pop fans and the hip hop guys, or an album that tried to.
Wow, we're touching this one now?
It's All Ready right. to Die.
Okay, we got 10 minutes left.
Yep, Ready to Die.
Get ready, everybody.
This is the last album.
Can we wrap it up in 10 but with this album?
This was released September 13, 1994 on Bad Boy Records, right? Okay. The acclaimed debut album, Christopher Wallace.
Yep.
Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. Notorious B.I.G.
Yep.
Right? So, raised by a single mother, started dealing drugs at 12. We heard the whole story in Juicy, guys. You know, listen to Juicy.
Yeah, let's not. We don't have to recite it again.
But here's one fun fact. People didn't know that he went to high school with DMX and Jay-Z.
That is correct.
So,
yes.
That was George Westinghouse High School.
Wow.
There you go.
Shout out to refrigerators and washing machines. Westinghouse? Wow.
Right. And Biggie Smalls was his favorite character in a movie called Let's Do It Again. Do you remember that movie? It's like an old black exploitation movie.
Oh, got it.
And
I'd never seen it.
And then his demo called Microphone Murderer, he was rapping over Big Daddy Kane's Ain't No Half Steppin' Beat, was discovered by DJ Mr. C.
That's right. Yes.
And then Mr. C gave it to Matty C at The Source.
Yeah.
And Notorious B.I.G. would be in unsigned probably the most famous person to come out of the Unsigned Hype section of Source Magazine.
Yep.
Right? Puff Daddy would basically be fired at Uptown Records by Andre Harrell.
Yeah.
And then quickly signs Craig Mack, and then signs Biggie to his newly formed Bad Boy Records.
Right.
And do you remember what Biggie's first appearance on Wax is?
Was that Dolly My Baby?
No.
The remix?
There was another. There was another big.
Oh, and Heavy D.
It was Heavy D Posse Cut.
Heavy D Posse Cut, right?
Yeah, a bunch of Iggas.
Right.
And it was on the Blue Funk album.
Shout out, Igor Mortis.
Igor Mortis.
Yeah, but that was a Posse
Cut.
Yeah,
it had Guru, Third Eye, Busta Rhymes.
Wasn't Third Eye part of Bad Boy?
I think Third Eye was signed to Bad Boy at one point.
Yeah.
Because he had that one song, What's Next, What's Up, something like that, right?
Yeah, he was on Dolly My Baby remix.
Right, right.
So maybe Puffy had some kind of deal with him, and then he fired him or something. I think he was there. But yeah.
But, and you remember who else was on that song? The Bunch Out? It's Rob O of I&I.
Wow.
Rob O.
Shout out. What are we going to talk about Rob O and I&I? Is that coming up?
I think we're a couple years away from I&I.
Okay, all right. Bacon Jacks.
But
everybody loves that song too.
Biggie, you know, even though he wanted to be just purely seen as a street artist, Puff had the know-it-all to like put him on the Real Love remix for Mary J. Blige.
Smart.
Put him on the Super Cat Dolly My Baby remix. And the rare one, if you guys can find it, is the Nene Cherry Buddy X remix.
Smart. Yes. And that she's Nature was big in Europe.
Yep, and she was big. So he got exposure over
the
there.
Europe market.
Super smart. And then he released his first official Signal Party and Bullshit
right.
on the Who's the Man
soundtrack. Right.
Right. And that was Easy Mo B. That was his first
right.
Experience with working with Easy Mo B, who was on fire at that time. Easy Mo B. Look at that.
He
guy.
Was of that era. Yes, he was. He was hot in that era. I never really liked that song. It just sounded too.
I actually prefer the Lord Finesse remix. If you remember the Lord Finesse remix,
you have that to play.
Sure, but
yeah, this sounds better.
When you originally heard Party and Bullshit, where you're like, the lyrics are okay, but the song's too fast, and like,
it's too fast, and his voice is good. His voice does not match fast beats, so it didn't sound right. He sounds good for slow beats, which is what got him mega popular with Big Papa and Juicy, One More Chance.
Here, this is the... I think this fits better.
Yeah, this is classic 93 beat.
And this is very Lord Finesse kind of beat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's got that treble back in the back.
And this is another one I had to go and find the maxi single for.
Right.
This. Really hard to find. You know? But Biggie recorded this album when he was 20. Like,
yes.
Damn, man. Like,
he's a young guy.
He did Party and Bullshit when he was 19.
Right.
So, right. It's like.
I mean, this I wasn't impressed with, though. It was really when he first released Juicy, which I didn't care for either.
Right.
But it was really the song that you played to start this whole thing.
I hate playing this because we've heard it way too many times, but Hawaii people love it.
And I get it. It's a cruising song.
Right.
It's like Warren G. You play Warren G, you play this right after. I get it. But Unbelievable is Biggie's best thing that got me excited to hear the album.
When you listened to Ready to Die, didn't you think that it was kind of weird? Because there were some songs that sounded super dated, and there were some songs that were like super slick and sounded really new.
You could tell something
was up.
Because
it took him a year to record the album.
Right.
And, you know, he recorded it from 93 to 94.
Right.
And then you could see Puff's hand in pushing him to work with more pop-ish beats.
Right.
And there's a... I think it's what makes this album great, but also, you know, a little, like, uneven.
Oh, very much
sound,
so.
Sound-wise.
Oh, yeah.
It's a classic, no doubt. But sound-wise, it doesn't all flow together as cohesively, I think, as
not at all.
A lot of people remember it to be.
Not at all. That's why this album isn't really a great album. Because it's too
Whoa,
confusing.
That's a hot take.
It's not a great album. Because you Whoa. Don't have where you're going with it. Because look, we have this guy who's this thug. Who's this guy that looks very menacing. Menacing voice. Probably one of the greatest voices of all time. And then he does these... Like this song right here.
Right. I mean, they really tried to go for the street. You can see where
this is a menacing
Biggie is pulling down. Biggie's pulling out more towards this,
right?
And then Puff's pulling it towards
this. This is like the if we have to compare something. This is like the Rise of Skywalker of hip hop albums. You got one guy going the other way. You got the other guy going the other way. You got Ryan Johnson doing this. You got what's his face?
So you feel the album feels like a tug of war.
It's a tug of war. It's a clear tug of war. You got really gritty. The lyrics on all of these is great. The lyrics, this has nothing to do with the lyrics. The reason why I say it's not a great album for him is because they didn't have a direction for this. It's either you take him to the party smooth guy, make him Big Papa, or do you have him take him go really gritty, talk about the street? What angle do you go with?
Yeah, the only thing that's really tying it together is that it's a concept album, because remember they're trying to tie a whole storyline where it's like,
right.
It's telling the story of his alter ego from his life to his death.
The grimier songs, though, because for him to go with songs like Everyday Struggle or Machine Gun Funk, and then you got Big Papa, it just takes you all over the place. If that was what they were fine with, okay. I would have liked to have heard like an entire like a boom bap Biggie song, Biggie album. Like Unbelievable.
No, there's no way Puff would have.
Right, exactly. That's not gonna happen. That's probably why they did the double album for him before he died.
Yep.
Because they had so much shit they didn't know what to do with.
Yep.
Let's make the boom bap song, let's make the West Coast song, let's make the party song.
Right.
You know?
So do you like Ready to Die or Life After Death more?
Life After Death has more clarity of what they were doing.
Yep.
You clearly saw, we're gonna cover all bases, make our double album. You got all
kinds of
You
got your premiere tracks on there, you got Notorious Thugs with Bone, right?
Tupac did the same too.
That's right.
And that was it. This one is like they didn't realize that you could make a double album. At this point in time, they're like, I don't think we can release a double album with this guy because he's new and this is his debut album. So
did you feel this album was overstuffed? It was overstuffed? Stop, look, and listen. I spit on your grave, then I grab my chalk.
You go one direction and then you go to the next direction with the next song. It just didn't. Because if you're listening to the entire Biggie album, are you listening to Big Papa all the way through? Or are you just waiting for Unbelievable to play?
I think the majority of our listeners that are like the pop music listeners are going to listen to. But the hip hop guys, probably not. And we're going to skip Big Papa most of the time.
Well, if you're a pop listener, you're not listening to this album in general because you're listening to the radio. So if you're going to listen to this album.
But there's so many people that claim their love and devotion for Big.
For his lyrics.
Right, I'm talking about the lyrics. Right.
His lyrics are brilliant. That's not the problem here. It's just a conceptual.
No, but how many people out there that like the general public that say they love Biggie, how many of them you think are real true, listen to this album all the way through, know all the songs?
Like they're not listening to it.
They're like a
singles
fan.
They're listening to singles. They're not listening to Tupac's album. But they're gonna take Tupac's to the God. But they can't name fucking 10 songs of Tupac. That's not I Get Around. We had this discussion. Same thing with Biggie. You're gonna name some hits because Biggie had bigger hits, but not an album.
Yeah.
You're not listening to an album. Okay, it's another one. Who Shot You? Warning. Great.
But this
classic
was a B-side.
Songs.
This wasn't even on it, right?
Right.
Wasn't this a B-side off the Big Papa single or something?
I believe so. Because Unbelievable was the B-side to Papa.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, to Big, yeah, to Juicy,
Big,
sorry.
Yeah, Big Papa was Who Shot You was the B-side to Big Papa.
Yes.
And this is the one that started the beef, right? Because Tupac listened to this and he
Correct.
Was like, What are you trying to say, man? You shot me at Quad Studios? You know,
that
like,
started the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, like, if you look at the album, the lineup of this album. Intro, okay. Things Done Changed.
Right.
That's a hardcore intro.
Yeah.
Of a song. And then Give Me the Loot.
Give Me the Loot.
Machine Gun Funk.
Mm-hmm.
It's still got that vibe. Machine Gun Funk, shout out to the DJ Premier remix of Machine Gun Funk. That's
yeah,
like
Warning.
Not many people know the DJ Premier remix of Machine Gun Funk, but then there's that.
Yeah.
There's Warning, Ready to Die. And then we go to One More Chance, which was not the One More Chance that's on the video.
That's clearly
they redirected One More Chance, and then we get Mary J. Blige in there, mm-hmm. and Faith Evans in there, and all that. And then the what? It. See, I just looked. You know
let's
what?
Play that Machine Gun Funk remix. This was super hard to find.
Yeah, this was.
I didn't even get this until Napster days.
Shout out Napster again. That's a recurring. As I'm looking at the lineup here of this album, there's 19
right.
tracks.
Right. It's a big, huge. It's a huge album. It's a long
right.
album.
You know what? I'll take back what I said, because it's really the redirection of the remixes and the later stuff that came out for the radio that made it a different character.
Okay.
Because if looking at this lineup, it fits for the most part, because One More Chance changed for the radio. Juicy was the only thing that they kept.
Right.
Big Papa was the only thing they kept. After that, there was really not much radio stuff on here.
No, because the One More Chance was remixed, the Stay With Me remix, right?
Right. And after that, that was it. So then they saw the popularity of Big Papa and One More Chance. That's where they went to the next double
right.
album to make all the
right.
smooth stuff.
Right.
And then all the premiere stuff. Yeah, so.
Well, this kid, he's still a phenom. I still really wish that we had a longer career of his.
Right.
I think he would, you
of
know.
Of course.
He was one of those, like.
Of course.
Like lyric savants too, or like he wouldn't write
right.
anything down because he didn't want people copying his stuff
right.
or whatever.
Right.
So he'd listen to the beat, write it in his head like Jay-Z, and just go in a recording booth and spit. Like there
you
isn't
that
many that guys,
much.
Man. Like
right.
wow, like. But you know he lost. Juicy lost its Grammy nomination to Gangsta's Paradise.
Right.
That was brutal.
That was pretty bad. That was pretty bad.
But
very bad actually.
But I think he had the last laugh because the album went 6 times platinum.
Exactly.
Right? Like,
exactly.
Huge album.
And if people bought it for One More Chance,
right.
Big Papa, Juicy. So that's how they make the money.
And you know what, with everyone being more conscious of mental health these days and stuff,
yeah.
actually there's articles written about how he actually explored PTSD and suicide on this album.
Exactly, right.
Which was kind of like, at the
right.
time, you know, like, you know, only maybe Scarface was really like...
You never touched that issue. You never
not really.
So for that... I'll redirect what I'm saying regarding this album, because I'm thinking too much of One More Chance.
The Source gave this 4.5 mics.
Yeah.
For the review, what do you give it now? What do you give it then? And what do you give it?
I gotta give it 4.5 as well. Okay. Because the lyrics are 5. The lyrics of him are 5.
Right.
Easily. The production, it still works. It still works. It works for this album. It works for this era. Would I listen to the entire album of this in 2020? No. Historically, it's 5 mics. Depreciation, I go 4. So, in 2020, 4 mics. 1994, 4.5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I agree. I think I agree. I don't revisit everything on this album, and I actually really don't care for a lot of the skits. I'm just over skits in general, right?
You know, who's in the car listening to skits about somebody on the street corner?
I don't know why so many rappers were compelled to do so many skits on an album.
They wanted to be cinematic or some shit. I don't know.
I don't get it. But yeah, I think the album is a classic.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to be in when we talk about historical albums, it will definitely remain in there. And once again, we won't have this conversation on this one again. You're going Biggie over Pac, right?
Oh, and the overall
Artist, lyricist.
Oh yeah, no, without a doubt, okay. No doubt.
Me too.
Yeah, there's no room for debate on that. There's no argument of any sort that can say Tupac is a better artist than Biggie.
Personality, maybe. As a figure.
Well, because Tupac is more out there. Because Tupac was an actor.
Right.
Biggie wasn't really an actor.
Right.
Would he have gone that route? Maybe.
Mm.
But if we're going off of that, personality-wise, okay, we get a point. We can check off that for Tupac. But musically, no. There's no way. There's no evidence anyone can present. There's no case that can be presented that will prove Tupac is a better musical artist than Biggie. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Don't message. Well, message Sky about this.
Don't. Right? No. Please.
Like the top three women rapper thing. You go message Sky on this, okay? I ain't got time for this shit. All right. I got a telethon to put together.
Well, yeah. I think that sums up.
All right, that
sums
it.
Up the episode, and I appreciate again. Yeah. Appreciate your time. 1 hour and 6 minutes. So a little bit over what our target is, but I just want to get those because I'm never going to ask you these questions again.
Better
so
not.
So isn't that a relief?
You better
you'll
not.
You'll never be asked these questions again.
I hope it's on record. Wonderful. Yeah, 1 hour 6. I knew we weren't going to hit 1 hour. I knew it. After you bringing up Biggie at 51 minutes in, as you tell me at the end of at beginning of these shows, oh, we're only going to hit 1 hour. So once it hits 1 hour, we're just going to cut it. Bullshit. Oh, with Biggie.
Well,
I just thought
we could edge that one in.
All
right. I thought we could edge that one in. I thought that would be a good one to end on instead of Keith Murray.
Okay, I give you that.
All right. I thought there'd be a better way to end the show.
No, yeah.
Because we're going to start the next episode with Keith Murray.
Oh, if that's not a teaser. If that doesn't get you excited out there, guys. Get ready for that one.
But yeah, we'll continue on with breakthrough debut albums for 1994. Dude, I appreciate you sitting through this again. And I think you really have incredible insight on the music and the culture. So I appreciate that, man.
I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy. I'm just trying to.
Standing here.
I'm just trying to make $1.15, man. Sitting here, yeah. All right.
Well, I hope for you hip hop nerds, I hope this was enjoyable for you, and we appreciate you guys listening. And sorry about the 2-week break between shows. Obviously, some delays were going on.
Hey, let me tell you this, okay? These aren't easy, people.
Yeah, these are very difficult.
We got schedules going on. All
right.
We have a thing called shout out having a job still yet in 2020. It's a lot of scheduling, got recording, uploading, all these things. So just. I want to try and release these every Thursday. This is technically Throwback Thursday.
So we missed the Thursday spots, but we got the back-to-back episodes recorded. So
we had 2 episodes recorded, so we're kind of ahead.
We're ahead of the curve. So if we miss a week, then we're there. But
yeah. So.
But anyways, man, I always appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right. Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening.